Good evening. I'm pleased to welcome you to the 19th Annual Frank M. Coffin Lecture on Law and Public Service. Thank you all for joining us tonight. My name is Peter Pittigoff. I'm Dean of the University of Maine School of Law, and we're so proud to sponsor the annual Frank M. Coffin Lecture. There's so many distinguished guests here tonight. Let me offer a special welcome to Ruth Coffin, and many members of the Coffin family. Thank you for joining us. We're certainly honored this evening to welcome Jonathan Lash as our distinguished Coffin lecturer. Jonathan Lash is president of Hampshire College. He was not president of Hampshire College when we invited him to deliver this lecture. He was in his 19th year as president of the World Resources Institute. And I think that Jonathan Lash's life and career really reflect the values and integrity and excellence that Judge Coffin so represented. In many ways, Jonathan is a member of the extended Coffin family. He was a law clerk for Judge Coffin in 1974 when Judge Coffin was chief judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. In fact, it was the judge himself who mentioned to me just a few years ago that Jonathan Lash would make an excellent Coffin lecturer. So here he is tonight. The community of clerks, of former clerks of Judge Coffin, is a very impressive and diverse group. It's a group of about 60 lawyers and judges and professors and civic leaders. They helped establish this lecture two decades ago, and they helped to sustain the tradition today and the spirit and momentum of this lecture series and to celebrate the values and legacy of their mentor. As you know, Judge Frank Coffin was a distinguished member of the judiciary, of course, and had an impressive career spanning all three branches of federal government. But it's his rich personal relationships that so many of us remember and value most. I'd like to note that our recent publication of the Maine Law Review is a symposium issue dedicated to Judge Coffin's remarkable legacy. It provides just a glimpse into Judge Coffin's wisdom and intelligence, his commitment to social justice and public service, his kindness, and his wit. Many of us remember his signature introductions to the annual Coffin Lectures. Once again, the Coffin clerks have stepped up to support this lecture series with a new chapter of introductions by people who knew the judge so well. We're fortunate this evening that Laura Castor will introduce Jonathan Lash. Let me introduce the introducer. Laura Castor serves as an arbitrator and mediator, including settlement negotiations and complex commercial disputes. She's an adjunct professor at Seton Hall Law School, where she teaches dispute resolution processes. Laura formerly spent a decade as chief litigation counsel at AT&T, and before that was a partner at the law firm Jenner & Block. She holds a BA from Tufts University and a JD from Boston University. And yes, she was clerk to chief judge of the First Circuit. Please join me in welcoming Laura Castor.
It's wonderful to be here tonight with Ruth and the Coffin children and some of the Coffin grandchildren and with all of you to introduce Jonathan Lash and to honor Judge Coffin in a way that he chose, by recognizing the public service and the impact of lawyers on the world. The Coffin Lecture lets us hear from one lawyer who has made a mark on the world through public service, and that is Jonathan Lash today, one of the judge's former clerks and the third of the judge's law clerks to join the very impressive list of Coffin lecturers. Anyone who has had the privilege of pulling up a turquoise chair on the porch of the Red Cottage or sitting with the judge and Ruth in a warm circle in South Portland knows that the twinkle-eyed questioning of the judge was often to a purpose. This was never more true than when he interviewed his clerks. It was during my own first clerkship year, I was lucky enough to have two, that the judge interviewed Jonathan. What was he looking for? Well, we know from the judge's own words in The Ways of a Judge. Since a clerk's work for me requires a high productivity in research, writing, and editing, I generally take someone with experience as an officer of a law journal. I suppose that in this kind of competition, where almost each finalist is superb in every category, I inevitably look for spark or brightness of spirit that engages me, that makes me sit up and relish the prospect of a year's company with the source of that spark. Sometimes I detect this attribute from the larger interests of the applicant, and I am attracted to students who seem sincerely bent on trying to contribute something to their fellow humans. The judge was interested in Jonathan's background and in his commitment to change. The judge knew that Jonathan's father was the biographer of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. Perhaps the judge knew more about Joseph Lash's youth as a radical, but I only just learned from Jonathan that his father became a historian because he was blacklisted by McCarthy. Jonathan's mother, too, was an activist and headed what became the Children's Defense Fund. Jonathan describes both his parents as classic liberal idealists working for pragmatic change in the world. The judge saw these influences, and in choosing Jonathan to clerk for him, added to them. On Jonathan's wall, there are five pictures of the people and places, he is an environmentalist, that have most influenced him. The place where he worked in the Peace Corps, his farm when he headed the Vermont Agency for Natural Resources, a photo of his mother and father, a photo of his godmother, Eleanor Roosevelt, and a photo of Judge Coffin, who influenced Jonathan in realizing the importance of governance, rights, humanity, and the ability to listen without self-righteousness. Jonathan has used his pragmatic skills in a very contentious and critically important arena. After a stint as a federal prosecutor, he worked at the NRDC and then went to Vermont, where he ultimately headed Vermont's environmental agency. He then became director of a highly acclaimed environmental law center at Vermont Law School. In 1993, he became the president of the World Resources Institute, where he remained until this year. And in 1993, he also became co-chair of the President's Council on Sustainable Development, a group of government, business, labor, civil rights, and environmental leaders appointed by Bill Clinton that developed visionary recommendations for strategies to promote sustainable development. He played a key role in the success of the U.S. Climate Action Partnership, which in 2007 issued a call to action on global warming. He was recognized by Rolling Stone in 2005, and he has an even more complete biography on Wikipedia. This year, he assumed the role of president of Hampshire College, which may appear to be a change in direction, but to Jonathan, is a seamless part of his commitment to future change through the young people at Hampshire College, who share the judge's and Jonathan's vision and energy for helping their fellow human beings. I take special note that Jonathan's talk includes in its title the word clever. That was a word that the judge and I determined would make a wonderful collective noun for the now more than 60 clerks who worked for him and were influenced by him. Members of the Clever who are here and I look forward with all of you to Jonathan's views on the challenges to a clever species.
This would have been a treat just for the opportunity to see Laura again and talk to her as she was planning this introduction. Thank you, Laura. Dean Pittagoff, thank you for the invitation and the introduction. Ruth and the wonderful Coffin clan, I can't tell you how touched and moved I am that you're all here and to be part of this family again that has meant so much to me for so many years, and members of the coffin clever, all of whom understand what I mean about the sense of attachment to this family through the judge. I'm so deeply honored to be included among the remarkable series of people who have delivered coffin lectures over the years. Although I blushed happily listening to Laura's kind words of introduction, I wanted to add a somewhat humbler introduction of myself. I am a lapsed lawyer. I haven't been in a courtroom in decades. I'm a recovering bureaucrat. I'm a refugee from the heady, self-important, increasingly mean-spirited world of policy and politics in Washington, and I am now a rookie college president and having a fabulous time. I wasn't planning to leave the World Resources Institute. It's a fabulous place, an effective and innovative organization, but as I've told several of you, when I was contacted by Hampshire's headhunter, I found myself ultimately musing that I'd been in this business of trying to change environmental trends for 35 years. And while I'd gotten to work on great projects with remarkable people ranging from the president of Brazil to the chairman of GE, the big global trends that I worked on had all gotten a whole lot worse faster during the span of my career. It just seemed like a good time to take the chance to work with students who will have to be the ones to change the world. There's no other way we can move forward unless they, and those of you who are students here, you do. So now I work with 1,500 very smart, very passionate, sometimes obstreperous, mostly idealistic college students in a remarkable educational enterprise. It's built around challenging students to dig deeply into their ideas and interests, to take responsibility for their own learning, their own actions, and their own world, and to learn to thrive in a rapidly changing world by being agents of change themselves. Hampshire has been named among the greenest, brainiest, and hippest campuses, whatever that means. But I have to say, the thing that has most struck me that I've come to know is that our alumni say that they're good at change and reinvention. Their ranks include an astonishing number of successful social entrepreneurs. For example, the founders of four companies that are creating new models for food and consumer products, Stonyfield Yogurt, Australis Agriculture, Applegate Farms, and Seventh Generation, all those companies were founded by Hampshire alumni. The ranks include three Oscar-winning filmmakers, a disproportionate number of environmental scientists, and a big group of people who seem to have invented their own jobs. Working in Hampshire is fun, has been so far. I don't miss Washington at all. I do miss the judge. Like all of his clerks, I was profoundly influenced by the experience of working for him. I not only got my real legal education in his chambers, I've spent the last 3.5 decades trying to live up to the standards of integrity, wisdom, and humanity he set just by the way he went about the job of being a judge. He was a model of how a wise and good man can elevate all of those around him. I only wish I could live up to his sense of humor. I want to talk to you today about individual rights and community. I've been struck in reading the judge's books and recalling working with him how he honored two competing ideas simultaneously: respect for individual liberty and a deep belief in the power of government to enhance fairness and promote public well-being. As I'll explain, the tension between those two ideas has become increasingly important in the debate over how to address global environmental problems. I'll begin with ants. The great Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson has spent a lifetime studying the nature, organization, and behavior of ants, and he's become increasingly intrigued by what he calls the altruism of ants, many types of ants will sacrifice themselves not only for their own progeny, but for their colony, their community. Wilson observes that ants and Homo sapiens are among the very few species whose actions are animated by altruism, and that the species that do behave altruistically seem to have been remarkably successful in evolutionary terms. Most human cultures, of course, highly value altruism. We give medals to those who sacrifice themselves for others in the battlefield. We celebrate the Good Samaritan. Religions treat selfless sacrifice as holy. Human beings don't see altruistic acts as the fulfillment of a genetic mandate, but rather as a supreme exercise of free will, a manifestation of the qualities that make us human. It's the freedom to act for the good of others or not that ennobles the choice. And of course, America's founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, enshrine the idea that individual rights are essential to freedom, reflecting the Enlightenment notions of free will and the value of individual responsibility that shaped the philosophy of the founders. Yet, those founding documents were also the basis for daring and creative collective action, a revolution and creation of an entirely new nation. And they set up one of the basic tensions of our free society by also establishing the basis and mechanism for those collective actions. The Declaration offered the rationale, and the Constitution established the mechanism to bind citizens to obey collective decisions that run counter to their own desires. The juxtaposition of individual freedom on the one hand and community interest expressed through the exercise of government authority on the other is not just an artifact of the founders' fear of the power of the king, it's a central element of our national character. And it creates a challenge for environmentalists, because the need for collective action to avert environmental catastrophe is so strong, and the actions needed so obviously limit personal choice and personal freedom. The $75 trillion global economy runs a big environmental deficit, and nature does not do bailouts. We take more from nature to live the way we do and dump more waste back into nature by living as we do than nature can sustain. Each of the basic natural cycles, the carbon cycle, the nitrogen cycle, the hydrologic cycle, is being disrupted on a very large scale by human activity. We're changing the chemistry of the earth, modifying its climate, and drawing down fresh water supplies. It's a big deal. We live in the Anthropocene era. Human activity is altering the fundamental biogeochemical system that we are a part of and on which we depend for survival. Now, this is not a catalog of environmental doom speech. The world is not going to end tomorrow. Yet I would offer as a premise that it is and will be increasingly clear and urgent that humankind must change its patterns of consumption and waste for survival. Okay, that's my premise for this discussion. And to do so, to make those changes, will require both individual and collective action on a global scale. We have to change both norms and policies. And those are actions that people in my field have talked about, proposed, negotiated about, and claimed to be starting on for most of the last four decades. I can tell you, we aren't making much progress. Notwithstanding a brief period of environmental leadership in the 1970s and sporadic innovation since then, the United States has been more an obstacle to than a model for action, especially on the most compelling global threat, global climate change. The political reaction that has made the current House of Representatives, in Congressman Henry Waxman's words, the most anti-environmental in history, and that has lodged climate skepticism with advocacy of absolute gun rights and opposition to abortion as a litmus test political issue for the right, has little to do with science and everything to do with the rejection of limits on behavior. A lot of people in the United States would say, with honesty, that they care about the environment, but they don't like environmentalists. They see us as bent on restricting consumption, taking away people's pickup trucks, and making life, well, a lot less fun. And that suspicion about environmentalists' intentions, our easy willingness to restrict freedom in order to protect nature, isn't just a Tea Party phenomenon. It even divides environmentalists from human rights activists, although one would think that our views would most often align. On this, I struggle a little bit with the pronoun, as I find myself in both camps, and I'm not quite sure which our I'm referring to. But think of some notorious examples of environmental pillage and its consequences. Chico Mendes. You remember Chico Mendes? He was the Brazilian rubber tapper, a leader from Japuri in the Amazon, murdered by ranchers for protesting their destruction of the forest his community lived in and from. Or Ken Sarawiwa, a Nigerian hero executed for protesting oil pollution and corruption. Or Yosefa Aloman, the elder of the Amungma people in Irianjaya, who was tortured, imprisoned in a cell a foot deep in feces because she protested the environmental destruction and violent suppression of rights associated with the creation of the Freeport-McMoRan mine. Or the Chinese peasants in hundreds of communities every year who are beaten and imprisoned because they protest massive and illegal pollution from local enterprises, often partly owned by local officials. Or the community of Anniston, Alabama, that was victimized by toxic pollution from a Monsanto plant for 30 years after a Monsanto consultant had told the company that the plant's discharges were so toxic they killed fish faster than battery acid. These are flagrant cases. I chose them to be flagrant cases of environmental destruction that injures people, hurts them, injures their livelihoods directly, eliminating their source of sustenance and income, wrecking their homes, or threatening their health. In each case, the victims also suffered from corrupt and illegal decisions and often violent repressions of legitimate protest. Indeed, environmental protest and movements for political rights often become intertwined. Natural resource destruction usually means human misery, often accompanied by the abuse of the most basic human rights. The victims are usually poor. The poor are least able to defend their interests, least likely to have or assert property rights. They have least access to technology to protect themselves. These aren't hard cases. Of course, environmental harm that injures people, degrades their land, destroys their livelihood, and steals their hopes for the future violates the victims' rights. What happened in the cases I described was morally wrong. It was politically antediluvian and environmentally reprehensible, a trifecta of abuse. But it's worth turning the analysis around for another look. There is still that puzzling tension between environmental rights and environmental human rights and environmental activists. If environmental and human rights abuse are often linked, our rights, the access to information, opportunity to participate, the right of judicial review, an effective antidote to environmental destruction. Well, that's not so hard either, right? There's the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA, a superb bundle of procedural rights that has proven to be a killing ground for really bad ideas. The Toxic Release Inventory and Community Right to Know legislation, which require disclosure of industry's use or release of toxic chemicals, have proven to be powerful incentives to reduce pollution. Information is power. Governments have always sought to control and managing it, applying the harshest penalties for espionage for those who steal information. Gutenberg, after all, launched a revolution, and ultimately the Industrial Revolution, when he invented movable type and made information more widely and commonly available. Twice in recent years, the Nobel Prize for Economics was given for work that explored the power of information. To Amartya Sen, who demonstrated that there's never been a famine in a democratic society with a free press, and to Joe Stiglitz, who showed how the efficiency of markets is distorted without the free flow of information. Shouldn't we actually be paying more attention to Joe these days? If information is power, control seems to be shifting rapidly. It took 46 years from the time the first power lines were rigged for one quarter of Americans to get electricity, 35 years for one quarter of Americans to get a telephone, 16 years for 25% of Americans to get a PC, 7 years for them to get internet access, and how long? 9 minutes and 40 seconds for 25% of Americans between 20 and 40 to get an iPhone 4? Then there's been the rise of civil society. There are now almost 200 nations, over 20,000 multinational corporations, and several million NGOs, each needing no more than web access to achieve global reach. And from the Orange Revolution in Ukraine to the Arab Spring, ad hoc groups have organized by text message, and they have swept away governments. The simultaneous expansion of access, reach, and usability provides an unprecedented opportunity for people to have a voice. It enables groups to form and act and amplify their voices almost instantaneously. In a connected world, procedural rights and access to information are powerful tools to strengthen the rights of the excluded. But the right to information is only part of the story. This satisfyingly symmetrical view that fewer rights means more destruction and more rights must therefore mean less destruction doesn't always work out. Those who act destructively assert rights as well. Remember where we started. The history of environmental regulation is one of applying coercive measures to restrict individuals' freedom to harm the environment. Coercion and individual rights just are not comfortable bedfellows. Consider our frameworks. Human rights advocates and environmental groups generally start from completely different premises. Human rights advocates address present harm. Environmentalists tend to focus on future risk. Human rights advocates are concerned with harm to people, while environmentalists deal with human loss in the context of harm to nature. Human rights advocates tend to defend the individual against the tyranny of the majority. Environmentalists tend to fight for the common good against the narrow interests of the individual. Human rights advocates seek to limit the power of the state, while environmentalists often rely on the regulatory power of the state to coerce people to do less harm. These are entirely different narratives, which is why the tension. This didn't seem so difficult an issue when Teddy Roosevelt was trying to protect wildlife and establish the rule of law in a few national parks. 40 years ago, when Senator Ed Muskie was pushing through landmark legislation to stop egregious corporate pollution, there were arguments about jobs and growth, but Americans, for the most part, saw government's role in compelling compliance as necessary and appropriate. In the Anthropocene era, however, as we confront problems that are creating consequences that are big, global, and irreversible, and can only be addressed through large-scale changes in behavior, the question of individual freedom becomes more difficult. People are not so sure government should restrict their right to choose inefficient light bulbs, wasteful toilets, and big heavy vehicles to avert harm to people in other countries, living in places they never intend to visit, living lives that they cannot understand. Consider global warming. Climate change is real. It is underway, and the emissions that cause it are increasing rapidly. Warming is happening more quickly with more significant consequences than science predicted or our society has understood. I don't need to catalog the evidence here, right? With this audience, I do have a flash drive here with 500 and some PowerPoint slides on climate change, and I'm not afraid to use it. Okay. Climate change is the quintessential global environmental issue. Emissions from one area of the globe affect the climate everywhere, although not equally. All countries contribute to the problem, although, again, not equally. While every country has emissions of carbon dioxide, most of the emissions come from the industrialized countries, and the United States, with less than 5% of the world's population, is responsible for over 20% of its emissions. Emissions from U.S. power plants alone exceed the total national emissions of 146 countries. The average American is responsible for 20 times the emissions of the average Indian, 10 times the emissions of the average Chinese. 2 billion people have no access to electric power, and another 2 billion have limited access to communication and motorized transport. Their lives have almost no impact on warming, but warming will have a significant impact on them. When sea level rises and storms worsen due to climate change, the Dutch will build dikes. American vacation homeowners will demand more government-subsidized flood and storm insurance. And the residents of Pacific Island nations will have to look for new places to put their countries. This raises some interesting questions about justice and rights. Whose rights exactly are important in this situation? Justice for whom? When our generation makes choices, or more importantly, fails to make choices, and thereby creates environmental changes that our children will be unable to reverse, but will have to suffer the consequences of, what principle exactly can we articulate for our allocation of rights between current and future generations? Whose rights should be protected, and who should pay the costs? This brings me back to ants. Like ants, we are an altruistic species, putting aside the fact that we sometimes slip into denial when we don't like the truth. In the end, we do behave altruistically. The trouble is we struggle to decide how many of our fellow human beings are part of our community. Are there boundaries of race or class or belief or nationality on what we define as our community? Unfortunately, we are surrounded by horrendous examples of communities defining themselves narrowly and acting altruistically to harm other parts of the human community, but we're all in the same boat on this planet floating through space. When I am tempted to despair in thinking about this division of the human community into pieces that are unable to act to deal with large-scale problems, I think about great campaigns to change human culture and behavior that have succeeded. Think of the elimination of state-sanctioned slavery, or the enactment of women's suffrage, or the slow but steady reduction of smoking, or global cooperation on vaccination and the control of infectious disease. It's often a heartbreakingly slow process where the moral case long precedes action. It took 60 years after James Wilberforce won abolition of slavery in Britain to abolish it in the United States, and decades more for the emancipation of the serfs in Russia and slaves in Brazil, but the transition did take place. It required economic and technological change as well as moral suasion, but human societies have consciously changed, driven to achieve community good. Those in the business of social change, which has been my vocation for four decades, need to hang on to the notion that it is possible for us to make affirmative choices that have long-term impacts on the course of the human race. Human ingenuity is so extraordinary. The fact that when we use knowledge, it is not depleted but grows is so powerful that I remain optimistic to the core. We can change. It is in our DNA. Thank you. Ed Wilson, by the way, has a book coming out on ant and altruism next spring, I believe. Peter tells me that there is time for questions or even comments or statements or disagreement, and I'd welcome it. Did you plant somebody to break the ice, Peter? Go ahead. One absolutely critical thing. Since I am negotiating with people about how to achieve common purpose, the starting point has to be some shared set of values. And I find that it is almost always possible to look into the future and find coincidence in people's vision of what is necessary and important in the future and work back from that to current agreement. We are all animated by vision, and the sense that we share something with others in terms of long-term vision enables us to listen to them to address short-term disagreement. Yes. I don't actually know enough science to answer your question intelligently. I haven't seen evidence other than a few cases where deep drilling has caused earthquakes, where there's attribution of large-scale earthquakes to human activity, but it's just not my area of specialty. First part of what you said I agree with entirely. Someone else. Yes.
I think you did a good job of answering the questions that you raised yourself. So I had a question 10 minutes ago, which was, how would you define yourself? Or are you defining yourself? But if everybody's happy with where you are right now, where would you go on from here? What would you say next? I think you may have stopped a little bit too soon.
Yeah. Listen, I just left Washington, we have been utterly unable to address this set of issues on a national level. And I don't see any short-term trend in politics in Washington that suggests that's going to change. It would be easy to become discouraged about that. But that explains part of why I'm happy working with 1,500 students. I believe to the bottom of my soul that the change will take place, and it's a question of when and how. So, I'd like to have a discussion with all of you about whether the Occupy Wall Street movement is a sign of something different happening. Our society is capable of acting quickly. We're just too divided right now. I'm not sure that answers your question, but yes.
At what scale do you think there is the best opportunity for change? Local, state, regional, obviously not federal.
Yes, so there is local change going on. If we took all the best things that are being done in big cities from New York to Chicago to San Francisco on energy efficiency and carbon reduction, the country would be off to a real start if we were doing that nationally. But you really can't solve these problems anyway but nationally. We have a national economy that's part of a global economy. We need to set rules that enable big companies to make large-scale investments, planning on selling products that reduce energy use and decrease our reliance on fossil fuels. If I can retell a story I told earlier today, I had the opportunity to work with the chairman of GE, Jeff Immelt, who's somebody I admire very much, which is ironic since when I was Secretary of Natural Resources in Vermont, I had a terrific battle with an earlier version of GE. And I was making a trip with Mr. Immelt and a couple of other industry leaders to do some lobbying on climate change in Washington in January 2010. And we went to see the Secretary of Treasury, Mr. Geithner. And Secretary Geithner was actually mostly interested in asking the business leaders questions about when they were going to start investing again, very much uninterested in talking about climate change legislation. And Immelt said something which I found absolutely compelling. Geithner was asking him about all the money that GE was sitting on and when they were going to invest it. And Immelt said, well, I look at three things. I look at markets, credit, and regulation. He said, there's going to be a market someday again in the United States, but there are bigger markets in Asia. There's credit available in the United States, not as easily as it should be, but there's a huge amount of credit available in Asia. He said, regulation is what's going to determine whether I can sell the products that I will invest in making. All across Asia, I see governments adopting policies, adopting regulation that will assure that I get a fair price for the products that I sell. And the United States is doing nothing. I'm moving my money to Asia. Don't expect it in the U.S. There was, yes. I don't make moral judgments. They're products of their investors' interest in maximizing returns, and many of us are their investors. They make their money by developing new reserves and selling the products to us to drive our cars. How can we make moral judgments? On the issues I have worked on, Exxon has been a real problem. They started out in climate change denial and traveled around the world trying to get countries not to take action. They have never articulated a positive approach to any of the environmental issues that I care about, so I guess I'd say they're an obstacle. But, you know, the country needs to change that. We need to send the signal that we have different expectations, and their investors need to make the choice that they have a long-term interest in a sustainable product. Yes?
I was pondering your observation that the American Congress has gotten more anti-environmental at a time when it's manifestly obvious that environmental problems are exacerbated. And I was thinking whether part of the reason for that might be that the class of people who are concerned about the environment tend to be comfortable upper middle class people who are proposing the addition of regulations and costs that bear down disproportionately on working class and poor people who would benefit from having a more vibrant economy with more jobs that would be competitive in the world, producing products competitive in the world. So that there is a misallocation of the sacrifice, and that has left political leaders, besides the corporate interests, that misalignment of interests has led to this kind of counter, this reactionary movement. I wondered if you'd talk about that.
So the polling data supports your argument. For most of the history of environmental activity in the United States, the environmental movement, there was not clear evidence that there was a class differential in people's support for environmental regulation, and the poor saw themselves as often victims of pollution. The current recession and 9.5% unemployment have changed that sharply. It's interesting to note that the United States has never passed significant environmental legislation when unemployment was over 7%. And so I think, you know, we do have a kind of a tendency to hunker down and say we don't want to add costs. We know this stuff adds costs. I also do think that there's another subtler and more difficult question for all of us, and it's about narratives. The concept that we need to focus on the long-term interests of the whole Earth is a part of a fairly elite narrative that is not shared by middle-class, lower-middle-class people as widely. And that probably is even more costly than the simple perception of economic interest. I don't know how to change that. I've racked my brains about that for a long time because I think we all have a totally shared interest. There's no difference in our interests in that case. Yeah, so I would have thought, like many of you, I believed when President Obama took office that he was going to be our voice on these issues, that he understood that it was important that there be a national leader who spoke for the broad interest of the nation and the community against those interests, the one person who would actually have the power to stand up, and I thought he would be a powerful voice. He took a different approach. I wouldn't even try to explain why. So we really haven't felt that there was anybody on a national level who was speaking out on our behalf on these issues. And I'm not surprised that people are suspicious about whether government can ever serve their interests. I certainly perceive that, which is, you consider my background, right? I'm essentially familiarly related to the New Deal, the greatest reflection of people's confidence that government could help them and protect them against uncontrollable forces. So I have this profound belief in government, and I see the country giving it up based on pretty fair evidence. Yes. I'm a lawyer, not a physicist.
Was not one of those slides? I mean, I believe in global warming.
No, I understand. You're asking a very sensible question. I do have one of those slides that shows the model. It's a very pretty picture illustrating the model of how the greenhouse effects works and lists the seven gases that have greenhouse impact. Why those molecules and not others are most important in greenhouse impact in terms of physical differences, I can't explain to you. Yes?
How much of the tension between community and individual is real, and how much do you feel is manufactured by sort of money interest? Because I'm thinking, I accept the examples you gave of how gasoline tax is a restriction, but the Germans alternatively, instead of making gas pricing it, they made biofuel more affordable. I guess I just want to know
I totally believe that the consequences of the, just take the example of climate change, of the legislation that moved through the House and did not pass the Senate in terms of impacts on people's lives would have been very limited. And in many cases, certainly in this state, beneficial. We can discuss exactly why, but I think the evidence of that, the economic modeling evidence, et cetera, is pretty compelling. But people's experience with government interfering with their lives, their outrage that their choices are limited, suggests to them that they don't need to listen to the detail. If government's going to get in their lives in a big way, that's going to make things worse for people who have come to distrust decisions made by government. So have you ever had the conversation with somebody who claims you can't get a good toilet these days? because of water flow restrictions? Well, all my experience suggests they work better, the low-flow toilets, but you'll still find people who just are full of outrage about the fact you can't get a good toilet and it's all the fault of the damn environmentalists. And I really do think this is as much symbolic as reality. And I do think that the opponents of action are very good at playing on it, but that's the way the game is played. There's nothing nefarious about making your most effective arguments. That's the way we work. Yes.
Why should we believe that this is any different from those?
Well, there are two reasons. One is that in this case, we can directly track the process of warming and how it relates to the increase of human-created gases in the atmosphere. So in all the previous episodes, there have been long-term natural causes that caused a relatively slow process of change. The second is that this process of change is moving fast enough and now looks like it's going to be on a scale large enough that it will exceed the boundaries within which our species has evolved to thrive. The consequences are ones that we will not be able to deal with without significant suffering. So even if there has been significant change in past millennia, it hasn't taken place rapidly when our species was active at the level we are now on the Earth. But put aside all that. Let's say that 100,000 years ago, there was a period of warming or cooling that had profound effect on the Earth. Even so, do you think human society can deal with that warming or cooling now without catastrophic consequences? Everything we've seen, all the rapid melting of the ice, the changes in rainfall patterns, the amplified storm impacts, the biological changes, changes in the onset of spring, which are making plants in certain areas, other animals, untenable, all of that that's now measurable. If you follow the science the way I do, you get a paper a week about this now, is the consequence of 0.8 degrees of warming. That's how much we've experienced since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Even if we stopped adding CO2 and other greenhouse gases to the atmosphere today, we'd still run up to about 2 degrees of warming as a consequence of what we've already done. So 2.5 times what we've already experienced. And there's compelling evidence that that much warming would have an impact on a set of feedback mechanisms on the Earth, including releasing methane, that would then accelerate the warming. If we continue on our current track of increasing emissions during the lifetime of Judge Coffin's granddaughter, who is here, we'll experience 4 degrees of warming. And it's just no historic evidence of what the Earth looks like with that kind of warming. I don't want to run that experiment. I'm not interested in seeing how it happens. Yes? Nice question. The single most important thing, and it doesn't matter how we do it, is to have a price on carbon. That is to send an economic signal that makes it more expensive to do things that generate CO2 emissions and thereby comparatively less expensive to get your energy from sources that don't generate CO2 emissions. Price on carbon, and it can't be flat, it has to go up. You have to continue to move the economy away from carbon use. There are lots of ways to do that, ranging from a carbon tax to cap and trade. The second most important thing is to create mechanisms that enable the institutions and populations in the United States to adapt to rapidly changing climate so that we reduce the misery quotient from what we're doing to the climate. There just are going to be consequences. We should be investing significantly in preparing coastal cities, in preparing southwestern agriculture, and so forth. The third is to continue to encourage the development of the breakthrough technologies that enable us to get the same services for less greenhouse gases. So everything from technologies that are being developed that would turn CO2 emissions from power plants into cement to the breakthrough that will come sometime in the reasonably near future in terms of the price point on solar electricity. It's all there. We're, as a nation and as a race, we're really good at all of it. We ought to be pushing it ahead. Carbon price is the first and most important signal, but there's a long history of successful government intervention in promoting technology, notwithstanding the current scandal about one federal guarantee for one corrupt company. Yes?
So in your new role as an educator, for those of us who are educators, how do we make sure that our students don't get really depressed? How do we make sure they still have hope? Because every time you hear a talk, you read something new, it's depressing. It seems like it's too late. And so how do we make sure that they feel that there is still hope?
So I learned about 17 years ago not ever to give an environmental doom talk without ending with a way forward. And I find at least the college students I'm now dealing with enormously responsive and resilient in response to description of alternatives for moving forward. I find them hungry to begin to imagine ways they could get their hands on these problems and do something that might make a real difference. A lot of the students at Hampshire are profoundly interested in food, and food's going to become a big, big issue in the next couple of decades, and deeply interested in the question of how we maintain food supply for 7 and then 8 billion people without the same level of destruction that we've seen from agriculture in the past. That discussion seems to pull people pretty quickly out of the slough of despond from just looking at the trend lines. My wonderful friend and mentor, the man who founded the World Resources Institute, Gus Speth, came out with a book a couple of years ago, and the first 8 pages are just a series of small graphs showing trend lines, and every one of them is just depressing. And I don't know how people kept reading. I told him he ought to take them out or at least put them at the end of the book rather than the beginning, but he has more of a Cassandra gene in him than I do. Should we take one more, Peter? Okay. Yes. I won't speak for Portland, Maine. I went from Washington, where I was, you know, pretty far left on the spectrum, to Hampshire, where I'm probably the most conservative person on campus. And there is a danger in that. There's a lot of political correctness around a lot of speaking to each other and being sure we're right. But I spent a lot of time, 2008, 2009, 2010, trying to speak to chambers of commerce all over the country and industry groups to make the case that it is in the economic interest of the United States to be a leader on these issues. I just think there's a huge opportunity. I mean, the Tea Party's way out there, but I don't find people in general in the country closed-minded on these issues. And if you talk to them about food supplies and water supplies and the lives their children will lead, I just find them deeply interested. So, yeah, it's a great opportunity. But there probably is an opportunity here, too. Thank you.